Get your films on with the Blurgs.
Once an idea has taken hold of the brain, it's almost impossible to eradicate.
Unpacking movies has never been more spot on, woke, fire, and just plain lit.
They are lit all the time.
So if you're unsure whether or not to plop down some cash for a film, check out the Blurgs.
When a man with a 45 meets a man with a rifle, the man with a pistol is a dead man.
Brando's got what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
You really only need to hang, mean bastard. But mean bastards, you need to hang.
Don't say you weren't warned. Ridiculous. Here's Brandon and Jeff.
All right. Welcome to a special discussion episode of the Film Blurgs. I'm Brandon Norwood, and I'm joined, as always, with...
I'm Jeff Stewart, and right here, we are honored
We are joined by Oren. Oren Soffer. Go ahead and introduce yourself, dude.
Hey guys, hey everyone. I'm Oren. Oren Soffer, cinematographer, and happy to be here.
And happy to have you.
Excited to nerd out with you guys. That's what we're here for, and I am a certified grade A nerd, so get ready.
All right.
Perfect. Jeff, why don't you go ahead and kick off with the first question? Whatever first question you have.
So we'll get into like the nitty gritty and everything like that later, but just, you know, give us an introduction to yourself, your work, your history. Like, just give us your elevator pitch.
All right, elevator pitch for me. As long as I can remember, I've always wanted to be a filmmaker. To quote Goodfellas, I loved movies as a kid. I was obsessed with Star Wars, Back to the Future. I didn't wear this on purpose. I just happened to be wearing this shirt today. Indiana Jones, Spielberg, like all of that. So those were my formative years. And I was also a really avid artist as a young child, painting, drawing, like anything I could do and get my hands on to express myself creatively. It's just constantly doodling and drawing. And then around age 10 or so, actually, I know exactly when it was. It was when the Star Wars special editions came out in 1997. And they released a VHS box set. And that box set came with a CD-ROM that was an interactive behind-the-scenes featurette, like, because this was before DVDs. So there weren't behind-the-scenes featurettes on the VHS tapes. But they put out a CD-ROM that you put in your computer and you could click around on Tatooine on what's it called? Man, I'm a bad nerd right now. I can't even remember. Oh, Tashi Station. Tatooine with Biggs, you clicked around and it showed you little behind the scenes vignettes about the making of Star Wars, about the original trilogy. And it's all this footage that people have seen since. It's like the footage of the TIE fighters against the blue screen and the motion control camera in the parking lot with the Death Star surface, like all the ILM stuff and shots from the set, like the boom op with the pink shorts in Tunisia, like filming the Tatooine scene. So anyway, all that was in there. And I saw this and I was like, man, I never really thought about, like, I love all these movies and I never really thought about what goes into making them. And I really like that. I think this is really cool. Like, all this stuff looks awesome. And I never really put two and two together about, like, this is how you made. And then later that year, we did a family trip to California. First time I'd ever been. Went to the Chinese theater, saw the handprints, went to Universal Studios, saw the special effects show and all the other stuff. And I think all of that together was sort of the spark that was like, I think I want to be a filmmaker. I like movies and I like art. And I think this is the combination of the two. And cinematography specifically, I mean, that realization came a little later, but it became obvious that that was the meeting point between my two interests. Like, cinematography is the expression of visual art within filmmaking. And so I think I naturally gravitated towards that. By that point, I was in middle school. I took up photography. I had my grandfather's old Minolta stills camera, 35 millimeter, and was taking stills and started to dabble in filmmaking, quote unquote, like with a camcorder and my friends, and we didn't even know how to edit. So we would shoot, we would edit on the tape. So you like shoot a shot and then cut and then turn around, shoot the reverse shot, cut, turn back around, shoot the next one, cut. And then when you play the tape, it like plays out the scene because you edited it in camera basically. So yeah, that was pretty much it. And then one thing led to another. I ended up going to NYU Film School and basically focusing on cinematography and shooting a bunch of student films and honing that craft and really, really dialing into that as my interest and my focal point. And that was pretty much it. I mean, by the time I graduated, I knew I wanted to be a cinematographer and pursue that professionally. And it's, I just love the art form and I love movies and making movies and watching movies and creating images. And it just all kind of converged. I'm really lucky that it worked. I managed to, you know, 14 years later, carve out a career. Since I started film school in 2010, so it's been 14 years, and here we are, still on the journey. Of course, we're only just getting started, but it's been fun. It's been really, really great, and my parents are super happy that I proved them wrong. Like I managed to do it. I can make a living off of this. I told you.
You know, I've bumped into you for now like over 10 years at a guild we share, because we share a specific guild. I don't want to get into it for obvious reasons, but we talk about you in a positive way at the guild, where we're just like, man, it feels so good to see him like working, you know, and being on, getting your due, you know. When, because the way we all look at it, you know, one of us wins.
Well, that really means a lot, and obviously that guild has been really, really formative for me too, like just the community and the celebration of films and everything that we do. So that's been like a really big part of that growth. And it's really great to hear that. So thanks.
And I just want to say, as an apology, if I ever came off as like confrontational or an asshole, it's just when we're at our screenings, like my mind's in 10 different places. Cause I'm like, I'm contending with, the upper board, because I know a lot of people on the upper board, that other critics like me in there who are incognito trying to play it cool, like, yo, we're just normal people. Yeah. And then there's me also trying to network with other filmmakers pop in and out. And it's just, because like I know I've given people looks and they're always like, I thought I hated you. I'm like, bro, it's me, man.
No.
My face, because like my mind's in 10 different places.
I never got that. So anyone who's coming to you with complaints is, I don't know what's going on with them, but I've never felt that, for the record. So, but I appreciate it.
So I want to know specifically, let's get into the creator now. Greg Fraser chose you.
Yeah.
Right? To shoot this amazing, and by the way, like seriously, congratulations, because it's a gorgeous movie for your first. Yeah, like, yo, I can't say, I gotta say this from like the bottom of my heart. Like, that's crazy. Like, I like all hats off to you, because what you did for your first movie is an achievement.
Yeah.
How exactly did Greg come to pick you and get you got on his radar?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I've been very lucky to know Greg for quite a few years now. I mean, we first met in 2016 or 2017. So it's been a while. It's been seven or eight years. And over that time, Greg is low key. He's very humble about this, but low key, just one of the most generous cinematographers in terms of mentorship, bringing up younger cinematographers and sort of bringing them on as second unit or like other collaborations and other ways to work with him as a way to kind of bring them into that world and level up. So I'm very lucky to be a part of that group, but also just worth pointing out that there are others, you know, that he also works his mentorship on. And it's just a really great thing to see. It's very inspiring for me. I've benefited from mentorship all through my career, including back in film school. I did three films with Reed Morano as a camera intern, as a PA, just running cable. And in the camera department and learning what it's like to be on a professional set that isn't a student film. So like, shout out to Reed. And I just saw her last night and I love catching up with her because it's like, look how far we've come. You know, you're a big Emmy winning director now, directing big movies, and I've managed to somehow actually make a career out of cinematography and like where we all started. It's really great to see. But yeah, so Greg has been a mentor, and I've been very fortunate to, have been on his radar, and he had been tracking my work and my progress. And I think was, you know, the circumstances of needing to bring on another cinematographer onto the creator were very specific about the timing. And there's like so many factors. It's one of those crazy butterfly effect things where you're like, if it wasn't for COVID and if it wasn't for the delays and if it wasn't for this and that, like, it wouldn't have happened. But all these things happened in a way that led to him needing to bring somebody else on, and thought that my background and my experience in indie films and just my taste level, which is similar to his, probably because I've been inspired by him for so many years and like inspired by his style and his look. Just thought that I would be a good fit for this as somebody who was young and as he would put it, you know, somewhat naive enough to go along with it. Now, and not in a bad way, just in a, like, I'm not jaded yet, you know, like I'm not cynical. I'm still eager to go on an adventure that would be unconventional. You know, it's not the normal way to kind of enter into a movie like this and execute it. So yeah, just needed somebody who was game and who had similar taste. And obviously Gareth had to kind of give his stamp of approval as well. And I think the way Gareth puts it, I'm quoting him, so this will sound a little self-aggrandizing, but I'm just repeating what Gareth has said in other venues, is you go on someone's website and you just look through their work. I mean, there's no other way to assess somebody other than just the work that they put out into the world. And what Gareth says is you scroll through someone's website and you just see images and you go, oh yeah, I would shoot it that way. I would do it that way. I would do it that way. And the more that accumulates, you just start to realize that there's a taste alignment. And that's really the most important aspect of a collaboration, is just that you share a similar taste and a similar way of viewing the world and creating images. And so that alignment was there, and that was it. I got the call, and next thing I knew it, I was in Thailand prepping this movie, basically. But yeah, it's a really, really surreal experience, that whole journey of getting the call and talking to Gareth and getting on the plane and everything. It happened quite fast, but yeah.
So let's talk about the alignment of the sort of sensibilities and everything like that. Mm. The internet is abuzz over the fact that you shot this, like, once again, this gorgeous movie. I just watched it again this morning.
on a
prosumer camera, on an FX3.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to ask, like the camera, because you guys built that, right?
Yeah. Well, to be completely honest, that was in place before I came on board the project. So the camera of it all was something that Greg and Gareth had already figured out while they were prepping the film. And the funny thing is I guess we sort of, maybe we were a little naive to it, but I think maybe we sort of knew what the reaction would be. But to us, it wasn't a really big deal at the time. It was just the right tool for the job. And I mean, I still feel that way about it. I think we all feel that way about it, that the whole point is that we're at a place with technology, with filmmaking technology, where the quality difference, I mean, there's no gap really in terms of quality. Like I shared a photo from the ASC Awards last night, today on Instagram, and somebody who's in the photo responded and asked me, like, hey, just a question, like, how did you get the professional photos from the professional photographers so quickly? And then I said, this isn't a professional photo. It's just from my iPhone. And that just, it just goes to show that, that like over the last 10, 15 years of the digital revolution, the gap between professional equipment, quote unquote, and prosumer or just straight up consumer grade equipment right. has so narrowed that you only really start to see the quality gap in the very marginal, like extreme breakage points of when you're really pushing a camera or a sensor to do something that it's not capable of doing. But the 95% of the middle ground of your average typical usage, like the quality level's there. The prosumer gear is really, really good. To the point where we assessed it, or not we, Gareth and Greg and Photochem and whoever else was involved in the decision-making on the post side, assessed the camera and realized like, yeah, this little camera is perfectly capable in terms of the quality of image to stand up to the standards that we've come to expect from professional cameras. And so it's not, I guess that's why to us, it didn't feel like a big deal because we just, it was assessed and it's like, yeah, the camera's capable, you know, so there's a novelty to it because a lot of people have that camera from a sort of prosumer standpoint and they don't really think about it in a professional context, but that's really the only novelty. I mean, the technology is there. And so it was really just chosen because it was the right camera for the job. And they needed the smallest, most lightweight camera possible in order to shoot the movie the way Gareth wanted to shoot it, which was basically this super guerrilla, low-key indie style of a very small crew and very small filmmaking footprint. And we didn't want to lug. I mean, if anyone's seen behind the scenes of shoots and you see what a professional camera looks like, it's pretty big and it has all these accessories and it's usually on a crane or on a big dolly, or you need all this. Once you start scaling up the camera, everything else scales up too. The support gear, the tripods, you need a bigger tripod, thicker legs and all this stuff. And it just adds up. And then you need a bigger crew to support all that gear. So that was what they wanted to strip down. And so it started from the small camera body. And that was really it. That was what went into the decision.
So were you intimidated at all? Like, I mean, when they were like, hey, yeah, you're going to shoot this $80 million film on an FX3.
Well,
have at it.
Yeah.
Like, was there any sort of like, oh, okay.
Yes. I mean, I would say, I guess I would call it trepidation, but the thing is, it was out of ignorance because I didn't know what the camera was capable of either. And then all it took was, well, first off, obviously I trust them. You know, if Greg says, okay, we're going to shoot on this camera, by the way, my initial reaction is like, oh, that's interesting, but also cool. I mean, if you trust it, then I trust it. Like, how can you argue with Greg? But I went in and saw the test footage. Like I went into Photochem and saw the test footage and what the camera was capable of. And you just instantly see what it can do. And then you just go, oh, I mean, I had never used it before, so I didn't even know what it was capable of. I hadn't really thought much about it, but yeah, it was an easy thing to get past. It was just a knee jerk reaction, but I was proven wrong. And I knew I would be. It was just, I think people, you know, even the prosumer label, quote unquote, is like, ultimately that's marketing. You know, there isn't actually a category of camera called prosumer and a category of camera called professional. We create those categories to organize different things into different boxes ourselves. And the camera manufacturers lean into it because that's how they sell cameras. They market to specific groups and specific use cases. But I guess what we sort of proved, we didn't set out to prove it, but I think what we did sort of prove, and Gareth, I think, had this theory that he has been carrying with him for his whole career, is that those distinctions are ultimately arbitrary because like there's nothing particular about quote unquote professional equipment that makes it more suitable for a professional shoot other than perception and convention. And once you let go of that stuff, the world is your oyster. I mean, we used prosumer quote unquote grip gear as well. and lights. So it wasn't just the camera, that ideology or not ideology, but that mentality filtered down through all of our choices. And I think that's a good thing. Ultimately, I think, you know, letting go of that. I remember when I was in film school, it was like, especially in the later years, you know, when you were shooting student films, we had access at NYU to certain cameras. We had a 16 millimeter, and then we had on the digital side, we had a Sony EX3, and then later they got these cameras called the FX7 or FS7. It doesn't exist anymore, but basically it's a prosumer camera at the time. It was 10, 12 years ago. But when you were shooting your graduate, your thesis films, your senior thesis films, what everybody wanted to do, if you had the money, was rent an Alexa, because the Alexa is a legitimate camera, a professional camera, a high-end camera. And these cameras that we were using, or a lot of people had DSLRs at the time that they just owned personally. So we would shoot a lot of student films on DSLRs, but for your thesis film, you wanted to level up from the DSLR. The DSLR was an amateur camera, and the Alexa is a professional camera. And I think that perception has never gone away, even though the quality of the cameras has gone, the gap has completely closed. But that perception is still there that, oh, the cameras that the pros use, that you see in behind the scenes on these big films that we all admire, that's what we aspire to. And if you're not using those cameras, you're not professional or legitimate or whatever. But ultimately, I think that mindset is completely of our own making, you know, and it's not really based in any technical reality. So I think we should let go of it. I love contributing to the letting go of that mindset a little bit and realizing that we have the tools to create great images and in our own pocket. And on the flip side, on the professional level, there's this whole class, quote unquote, of tools that we dismiss that actually have great advantages to us if we just open our mind to look at things that cost less than $100,000. And you'll see that actually there's some really good stuff out there that's geared towards prosumers, quote unquote, or is cheaper to purchase, but serves a purpose, serves a really important purpose. So anyway, that's my rant.
No, it's great. And I totally agree with you. Like, I was having this conversation the other day with somebody, and we were talking about like the Blackmagic cinema cameras.
Yes.
Because I'm a Blackmagic fanboy versus, you know, an Arri. And yes, Arri, better. But if you're, unless someone's really pixel peeping, you know, the audience isn't going to notice.
No.
Right?
No.
If you light it right.
And that's the most important thing
you're supposed to do.
Exactly. The audience ultimately is not going to notice. Now, where you do notice it is in the filmmaking process. And what you get from Arri is reliability, ease of use, engineering. I mean, this is a legacy camera company that's been around for 100 years. They know how to design cameras, and they work with professional cinematographers in order to design cameras, which is something that Blackmagic doesn't do. Because they don't have to, because they're not designing cameras for that kind of use, right? Right. So the Blackmagic is geared more towards quote-unquote prosumer, same as the FX3. It's designed for a single person to use. It's designed for personal use, whatever. Whereas the Arri is specifically designed for ease of use and workflow integration into a higher-end method of filmmaking. But that's really the only place you see the difference is in the process of actually physically using the camera. And the FX3 was a learning curve. Like our camera team had to learn the camera in order to create a workflow around it. We basically had to create our own bespoke workflow, that's the advantage you get from Arri. There's a well-established workflow with Arri, Sony, Red, whatever, cameras that have been used on a professional level. But that's really the difference. Like that's where you feel the difference is on set, not in the final film. And I think that's the important thing, is that from an audience perspective, you're not going to know, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I just wanted to real quick, before we get deeper into the production side of things, watching it last night, I want to know, the you guys added film grain. Was that through the lenses you chose, or was that a filter you put in post?
It's a post process. So Photochem, which is the post house that we worked at, and our colorist Dave Cole, Photochem actually pioneered a process of printing a digital graded film to film and then scanning it back and getting organic crystal silver halide film grain and other patina from that process. And they did that on Dune and The Batman, and Greg has sort of been using this quite a bit, and other films. We tested that process and we wanted to do it. And the problem is we ran out of time because it takes time to print and scan back. And then you have to kind of basically go through the whole film again and color match the film scan back to the digital grade so that it looks the way that, you know, you just spent months grading a film digitally, and then you scan it back in film and everything's out of whack, or it's like super magenta or whatever. You have to kind of match it back. We didn't have time to do that. And so we ended up creating the film grain artificially, but basically nowadays all the post houses, and there's also off the shelf plugins that do this, they use actual scans of film grain. Like they scan pieces of film that are exposed to dark, to black, like it's just a black screen. So all you get is grain. And then they use those as plates to basically, you overlay it over the film, over your movie, and you can control the level of graininess, and you can control if it's only in the highlights or the midtones or wherever. So it gives you a lot more customization and ability to control the and modulate the levels of it. But it is technically actual film grain because it's scanned from an actual piece of film. So yeah, it has an organic look, but it is an artificial process ultimately, something we added.
I'll be real with you. That's why I wanted to ask, because it looks so good. Because sometimes you can't tell, like, oh, they just added on a filter, but this, it looks authentic. And I was like, I knew the camera you guys shot on. I was just like, damn, that is a great film effect that y'all
have. Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's technology is in an amazing place right now. The things that we can do and the things that people have come up with, like, there's plugins you can purchase that do this. I can't remember the name of it. Somebody can look it up, but it's like a plugin for DaVinci Resolve. So, you know, anybody can. Okay. DaVinci Resolve is free software, in case anyone's unaware. Free editing and color grading software. The pro version just unlocks certain professional features that if you're just a, you know, one person band or whatever, like small filmmaker, you don't need those features. Those are, they're just for like high end deliverables and stuff. If you're just making your own movies and editing and coloring them, then the free version is more than enough. And yeah, you can purchase and download this plugin and you get like live film grain and add it to your project and it looks pretty good. So
now if you had the choice, would you rather shoot on film or stay with digital?
I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but it's not a rivalry. I don't believe in film versus digital. I don't think there's a correct answer to this question, and I don't dismiss any capture format that exists or anybody's preference for capture format. Personally, for me, I'm a digital person. I prefer digital. I prefer the workflow of digital. I prefer the on-set experience, and I prefer the control in post. Film is cool, but at the end of the day, I am a student of the Steve Yedlin school of technical assessment. And in case if you guys know, Steve Yedlin, cinematographer, shoots for Rian Johnson. He shot all of Rian Johnson's movies, and he is a zealot about this exact topic. And his philosophy, it's not a philosophy, it's, he would call it just a, I don't know, scientific area of study, because he's very technical about it, is that ultimately, especially in this day and age, the camera is just a data collection box. the medium that you collect the data on at this stage and where technology is right now is ultimately irrelevant, because even with shooting on film, the truth is that ever since the early to mid 2000s, when we switched to digital color grading, shooting on film doesn't make a huge difference, because film stocks are extremely sharp and extremely clean these days. So you don't even really have that look. Like when people talk about the film look, they're usually talking about film stocks that don't exist anymore, that are from like the 90s, 80s, and 70s. Modern film stocks are very clean and sharp. If you watch like Westworld or, you know, some of these other movies or shows that are shot on 35 millimeter film these days, they kind of just look like digital. Like they just look really pristine and really good and sharp and clean, because that's just how good film stocks are these days. So that's part of it. And then the other part of it is you're always going through a digital process of color grading. Even when you acquire on film, you shoot film, you scan it back, you scan it in a log Cineon color space, similar to digital log C, which is designed to replicate Cineon. And then you digitally color grade it. So that process, the digital color grading, is the same whether you've shot on film or digital. It doesn't matter. So your negative, ultimately, whether it's film or digital, is sort of irrelevant to the final look of the film, because all the like visual aspects of film, of emulsion that people like, you can recreate artificially. And at this point, you can recreate them pretty well, to the point where certainly an audience member would never know the difference. And even the most discerning cinematographers or filmmakers probably can't tell the difference. So with that in mind, the only difference between film and digital is the discipline of capturing it on set. Like, what is it like to roll film through a camera, through a shutter, and pull focus on it and monitor it when you don't have HD or 4K rendering of what you're getting. You just have a video tap that's giving you an approximation of what you're filming. And I just don't prefer that method of filmmaking. Like, it's just extra work to me. You know, it's just like extra steps and extra things you need to do for an end result that is kind of, it could be the same. I mean, you know, if I want the film look, I can get it other ways. I could print to film and scan back. The shoot on digital, print to film, scan back. So for me personally, I like my philosophical approach to filmmaking on set is we have time is the most precious commodity on a film set. Every second is worth thousands, if not more, dollars. Like every second you spend on set, you have a crew of sometimes hundreds of people. You've got actors that are getting paid millions of dollars. Everybody's traveled. Everybody's come to this place. You have props, costumes, sets, all this stuff. If you're not maximizing your time filming and capturing footage and utilizing all this stuff that you've collected, you're wasting that precious commodity of time. And to me, reloading film mags and measuring, taping out and light metering and all the stuff, all the extra steps you need to do to shoot on film, it just takes away time to shoot. And digital is the most time effective tool to use on set. And you have your monitor, you see exactly what you're filming and all that. So that's my personal preference. Long answer to that question, but everything's valid. It's all good. Hoyta, Nolan, Spielberg, P.T. Anderson, all of them.
I mean,
I love it. I love their stuff and I love what they do. And if they have a different workflow and it's great and it works for them and I love it.
I mean, I got to jump in and say, you know, the digital to film look is actually a unique look. Like I'm seeing on Tuesday a 70 millimeter print of Dune and I'm excited. Yeah. But, you know, they just re-released Tenet, and I went and saw Tenet twice in IMAX 70 millimeter. And beforehand, they show like a whole 8 minute reel of Dune Part 2 in 70 millimeter IMAX. And I like I saw it in Dolby Cinema because I went to two different screenings, two different press screenings. And the colors are sharp and crisp, right? And it has, and Dune has a certain look just because of Greg's process. But I gotta say, I do like the look of 70 millimeter IMAX, where that crispness, that crispness is just washed out. Like the colors in IMAX are washed out, and I love how it looks because it makes Dune feel even more alien than it is. And I'm just like, this is such a unique look. Maybe we should try experimenting more, shooting digital and then projecting.
Absolutely,
on
yeah. I actually really love that they're doing that. I'm seeing Dune in 70 IMAX film this week, and last year I saw Rebel Moon Part One projected on printed 70 millimeter at the Egyptian Theater. I will not talk about the movie. Enough said, but
how did it look?
Yeah,
but
visually, like the aesthetic of the printed 70 millimeter projected, like looked really cool. And then I have to say that I watched like 2 minutes of it on Netflix later because I was just curious. I was like, what does the digital version look like? It's so different, and it feels like it was missing something that 70 millimeter look had. So I completely agree. I think it's just cool that. This is definitely a new thing. Like we haven't really seen that before. It's cool, and I hope more people do it. I really do, because it's the best of both worlds. To me, this is the solution to this question of we love the look of film, we love the feel of film. So how do we get the best of both? The workflow from digital, the look of film, and here we are. And the one exception also I'll add to what I was all saying is that shooting IMAX film is not replicable. Like that, what Nolan and Hoyta do with 15 perf IMAX and actually shooting with the IMAX cameras, that cannot be replicated right. In digital, because there's such a specific look to that, like that level of sharpness and clarity and the brightness and the contrast and the fall off of shooting and then projecting like IMAX film. That there really is nothing like it. So if you're going to do it, if you're going to say, I want to shoot on film, shoot IMAX.
IMAX.
Yeah, exactly. Or 16 millimeter, by the way. Or you go the other way. Like you shoot really grainy 16 millimeter, because that is a very specific look that can be replicated in digital. It can, but it's a lot trickier because it's quite specific. And it's also very different in terms of the sharpness levels and the optics and the way lenses work on that format. It's very different. So it takes a lot of detail to recreate that in digital. And I do think it's possible, but you might as well just go shoot 16 millimeter. It's at that point, that's easier. So those are the two extremes that I would say that like totally validate the choice to shoot on film for me, at least.
I mean, but you know, Greg cracked it, right? Cause Dune, we get to shoot the full 1.3 aspect ratio of IMAX. And I was just, once he achieved that for the first Dune, I was like, oh, well, I mean, look, why bother now? Like, let's just build like real IMAX digital cameras that can shoot in the real IMAX aspect ratio of 1.3.
Yeah, and they do. I mean, the Alexa 65 and the LF, like the Arri cameras, they have a 4x3 open gate form that uses the sensor, sensors. Right? It's the same aspect ratio as IMAX film.
And I gotta say real quick too, I am jealous that you got tickets for Dune IMAX 70 because the site crashed and I could not get a ticket until 6 hours later, and not till March 17th is the earliest I could get a
ticket. I got a ticket, but for a week after the release. I mean, I saw the film on digital IMAX the other day, but the 70 IMAX I had to wait a week to get good availability, and we're going in the middle of the afternoon. But you got to do what
Which
you got to do.
Which theater can I ask?
CityWalk, Universal CityWalk. That's our Lincoln Square. Like that's the LA equivalent of that IMAX screen. So
yeah, because I know you guys got three out there. It's that one, the Chinese, and then Irvine. I think the
that's
Regal
right. And I've never been to, because I can't step foot in Regal because they. They only serve Pepsi, but the Chinese theater is interesting because actually that screen is wide. it's actually designed for 70 millimeter, not for IMAX. So when you show a 4x3 IMAX film there, they actually mat the sides. So it's it. Oh, yeah, so it's a bit of a smaller screen because it's not as tall as Lincoln Square or City Walk, because it's actually not it wasn't designed as a 15 perf IMAX screen, but they do screen that format there, but it's actually smaller. So pro tip, City Walk is the place to go. Chinese Theater is amazing, but there's bigger screens.
So back to the creator. I want to first and foremost ask, what was the first day on set shooting like?
Well, we had spent 3 months scouting. So sorry, my voice is cracking. I lost my voice last night. The scouting process was very thorough. And as a result of it, like we had visited most of our locations, sometimes more than once. Like the location of our first shoot day, we had visited there twice, once on a director's scout and then on a tech scout with a bigger crew. So by the time we got to our first shoot day, that was our third time there. And in addition to that, we were also doing a lot of test shoots, testing our camera, lighting setups, our lighting approach and philosophy. Testing the set workflow, the AD, the sound, the actors, like all of it together. So by the time we arrived to shoot our first day, it kind of felt like we've been here before. We know what we're doing look-wise. We've tested it. So now the only thing that's different is instead of this small little band of rebels that were going around on this scout, like small crew, we have 400 people. And there's also this sort of added emotional, psychological pressure of we know that this is our first shoot day, so it's important. But also, like, we've done this before. We've been here. We know what we're doing. And so it was this mix of comfort and nerves that I think was really interesting. Like, it's obviously nerve-wracking to have your first shoot day. But I think we had done really thorough prep, so we felt ready. And that was a good feeling. I think it was a real testament to how much we prepped and test shot and scouted. So yeah, it was really fun. It was interesting. It was a tough day. It was a 4-page day, which is a high page count for a feature. Yeah. We had two like relatively lengthy dialogue scenes to shoot in this one day, as well as some other little tidbits. So yeah, it was a lot to get, but we got through it and we had a plan, we executed it, and it went great. We wrapped on time and everyone felt good. All right. It was a good start. It was a good way to start. It was hot as hell too. It was so hot.
Well, it was, you know,
it's absolutely,
you know, Southeast Asia. You know.
Southeast Asia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, and we were in an interior, and here's the thing. In Southeast Asia, interiors can go one of two ways. They're either air conditioned, which is awesome. Or if they're not air conditioned, they are way hotter than outside. Like, and the outside is hot. So like if you're on an exterior, you already know what you're getting into. Like it's going to be hot. It's going to be sweaty. It's going to be humid. It's going to be 95 degrees. You're good. Interiors though, like when you're in like a sweltering, unair conditioned interior, it's hotter. It's so much hotter. And you got the lights and everything. So yeah, it was an experience for sure. Like
so the sweat on John David, that wasn't glycerin.
We would never have to add artificial sweat on anybody throughout the entire film. All of that is 100% natural sweat anytime you see it. Anybody who's shiny in the movie. That's the real deal.
So now I gotta ask, because it was so hot and you guys were sweating, did you guys use tracking dots for AI characters? And if you did, because it was so hot and sweaty, would they fall off?
You know, I don't know what makeup they used, but those never ran, even when they were sweaty. The makeup team also was really good about keeping everybody padded down and cool. But yeah, the AI characters had minimal tracking markers on their face. It's not the full like dots across everything that you sometimes see when you do motion capture. So it's just three little dots that were very easy to miss, but very well easy to miss if you are not looking for them. But obviously the VFX artists were looking for them because they were there for tracking. So that was always the deal. I mean, that was, they actually did a lot of testing to figure out like what was the perfect balance of, we don't want it to distract or take away from the face or become something that you're going to have to like fight against later, but also it needs to be present enough that they can get the tracking data that they need for the visual effects. So it actually took some testing, but they figured it out.
So what was, or two questions, I guess the same question. What scene are you most proud of having shot on the movie? And the opposite, what scene, if you had the chance to go back and do something different, what scene would that be?
Well, I think it's funny, the lighting setup that I always point to as the one that was one of my favorites and that I'm super proud of is one that's barely in the movie because there's a larger scene that kind of got cut and there's only a few snippets of it left, but there's this whole scene in a nightclub where Joshua meets Maya for the first time. It's a flashback, and there was originally a whole scene there, and I just loved how that looked. Like, I just thought we totally pushed and really nailed it, and we worked really hard on designing the look of that nightclub to feel like futuristic but also kind of earthy and grounded, and like feel like a seedy nightclub in Bangkok, which it was. Well, it was in Phuket, but also like have this futuristic vibe. So we worked really hard on it. And there's a few shots of that scene in the movie, but the whole scene is gone. But that was always my favorite, I think, lighting setup that I keep pointing back to and thinking about, like, I really like that one. In terms of what I wish I would have improved, this I feel like happens all the time, but it typically takes like 2 or 3 weeks to really get into the groove of a film, especially a longer movie. And we shot for 30 weeks, I think. I can't remember exactly, but something like that. So, you know, by week 4 or 5, you really feel like you're in the groove. And the stuff from the back half of the movie, especially, or the back half of the shoot, I think looks like amazing. We found our lighting approach. We found our groove. We found our like go-to. But the first couple weeks, you're still sort of figuring it out. Like, it's something that I've heard other people say before as well, is that no matter the amount of prep and testing and talking and designing that you do, you only really end up honing the look of the film once you start filming it. Like, there's just certain elements that you can't fully account for and test for until you actually start getting the actors, the wardrobe, the sets and everything in front of the camera and shooting. So there's a few scenes that we shot in the first 2 weeks of the film that when I watch the movie, they stand out to me because I'm like, the lighting is just not quite refined in those. And like, I love the later stuff. But of course, in the movie, it's all edited out of order. So as an audience member, you probably wouldn't notice like what those scenes are, but to me they stand out, and I don't know if I want to say which ones they are, but suffice it to, because I don't want to draw attention to it, because other people, you know, would go back and scrutinize them. Although I obviously also know that I'm just in my head, and most people would look at those scenes and say, "What are you talking about? They look totally fine." But it's, you know, that's just my own like, but I wish I would have done this and this and this different or better in that scene. So anyway. That's a natural part of the process, I think.
All right. Well, I know your time is coming to a close end, as you're a busy man. So I just got two questions. And the first one is I ask everybody, because yes, this is something I've learned, you know, going through film school myself, is like every project is difficult and you learn something new on every project. So what did you learn so far that you're going to take with you for the rest of your career going forward?
I think I learned two things. And one is just what we talked about before about not being closed-minded to quote unquote prosumer equipment, and not to limit yourself in terms of what equipment you consider or think you have access to. And not just equipment, but also filmmaking approaches. Like, you know, we didn't get into it on this podcast, but this stuff is widely available out there at this point. And by the way, I guess shout out to my own Instagram. I've been posting some behind the scenes images and videos from the shoot in an ongoing series.
They're fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to follow you right now.
Thank you. So yeah, I got a couple more posts lined up, but basically it kind of takes you through the whole shoot, like chronologically. And I tried to highlight and point out like kind of the fun, scrappy filmmaking, like indie guerrilla filmmaking techniques and approaches that we took. So I think that even on an $80 million movie, like still thinking about things in that way and thinking outside the box, I really took that to heart and learned that. And the other one is just the power of collaboration and trust. Like this whole process was such a learning curve in a good way, in terms of like really working with a director who has such a strong vision, figuring out how they share and express that vision and collaborate with their other artists and their department heads to accomplish that, as well as the collaboration between myself and Greg, like working with another cinematographer, another artist, and really like letting go of ego and just embracing the collaboration and the shared experience and taste of producing the project. Not that that wasn't on my mind before, but I think most of the films and projects that I've done up until now, like in the indie space, you're just working with a smaller crew. And so it's like a lot ends up on your shoulders. And so I think, yeah, like being exposed to that kind of level of work and with those kinds of artists and that caliber of filmmaker, Gareth and Greg, and our production designer, James Klein, and our producers and the post team and working with ILM. I mean, just to close the loop, like that was my child. That was what got me into it. Like watching the behind the scenes featurettes on Star Wars about Industrial Light and Magic and their work on the film. So to be able to now work with those people, I mean, like it was total pinch me dream come true. And by the way, our props and hero costumes were created by Weta Workshop. And the Lord of the Rings was also like the formative experience for me. And those behind the scenes featurettes on the DVD, which I'm looking at right now, it's on the shelf right there. The appendices on the extended edition DVDs, those were super formative for me. Like as a young, I was in middle school and it was just like, I inhaled that stuff. So same thing, like being able to work with ILM, Weta Workshop and all this stuff and like that power of collaboration. And I really took that to heart. And I think that's something that now as I'm looking for my next projects and whatever else is coming along, like moving forward, that's just something I'm really prioritizing, I think, is like looking for opportunities to create that kind of collaborative environment. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was the first question and great. Thank you for that answer. Cause that was a great answer.
My
but
pleasure.
My second now and final question, at least for me, is your hat in the ring, sir, now for the next Jurassic?
I genuinely don't have anything to say about it. Like the answer is I can't answer it.
Did he wink? Did he just wink at us?
No,
I think he just winked at us.
You can't interpret anything from anything I just said. It's truly, and I'm not just doing a bit. I don't know. It's so early in the process of that film, so it's I don't know.
so to sort of bounce off what Brandon just asked, all right, what are you working on next that you can talk about?
Well, in between films, I shoot commercials. And that's what I've been focusing on. Basically, I shot a fun commercial with Jack Black the other month and a couple of Lakers players for Kung Fu Panda 4. Jack Black's teaching them how to embrace the inner panda to become better basketball players and improve their skadoosh dunking skills. So I've been working on that. I just shot a commercial in Thailand for a bank. I got a few others lined up. So not very exciting stuff, but pays the bills and I enjoy it. It's a great way to meet filmmakers and try things out and experiment and have fun and work with friends, and tide me over until the next film presents itself, which currently I don't have, but we'll see.
So what? So
it's coming soon.
Thank you.
Like, you're good.
I appreciate that.
So what's the dream? Like, what, like, what would be your dream project?
I'm putting this out there, manifesting. I'll tell this to anyone who will listen. My dream project is live action Batman Beyond. I was obsessed with that cartoon as a kid. And to me, it's a no-brainer. Like, I can't believe they haven't done it yet. Like, it's so obvious. Right? I mean, it's just, it's low-hanging fruit. It's right there. Yes. You get 80-year-old Bruce Wayne. Bring back Michael Keaton. I mean, they already kind of wasted that on The Flash. Like, they could have saved it for this. And then young 20-something Batman Beyond, set in the future. It's like Blade Runner, Akira, but with Batman. Like, how does this movie not exist yet? I don't know. But I want to shoot it.
I just got to interject and just say, you know, just as a fan of that character, it's wild to me that they don't use the Bat family in general, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Nightwing.
I know.
Red Robin. None.
You can't even get a Batman and Robin movie, much less like the rest of them, which is totally crazy because it's such a good dynamic. And it's so funny because in animation, they use them all the time and they use them well. Like Harley Quinn, the animated show. Has a great Bat family dynamic. Like, I don't know what, I don't know. I don't understand it, but whatever. I mean, I don't know what's going on at that studio. Clearly not great things. even regardless of this, but, so Batman Beyond, there's sort of like a cliche list of films that any DP would probably have similar stuff. Cause this is all the stuff that DPs like, but like I did shoot a big sci-fi film, which was a dream. So that's like super cool that I got to do that. And I would obviously do it again. Western, black and white movie, like especially if it's something like a noir would be really cool. But also I would love to shoot something like Ida or Cold War or something like that. Like just beautiful art house, like pristine, austere black and white. Like that'd be so cool. Musical. I love musicals. I want to shoot a musical, but it has to be a gritty one, like Chicago, like not bright and colorful. Like I want something gritty, like Cabaret. That's all of those would be on the list. And I'd love to shoot big movies, but also, you know, I have DP envy for stuff like Past Lives, which I thought was just so beautiful and so beautifully shot. And Shabir Shabs is he's a friend and I love him. And he's so talented, and that movie looks incredible. And it got zero attention for its cinematography, and I don't know why, because it's just a beautiful looking film. But
and elegant too, right? It's so stunning. Elegant. I'm like, how is this small movie so much more elegant than movies so much more?
Because bigger? It's the thought, it's the creative and artistic thought process of shot design, composition, color palette, lighting, like all of it. That's cinematography. And it's just like stuff like that that's so subtle often doesn't get attention, but other cinematographers notice it and we're like, oh, that's the good stuff. Like the big flashy stuff is cool too, but like that's the goods. So I just want to make good movies. Like I've been a cinephile, like I said, my whole life, like all the way back to being a kid. So I want to shoot movies that I would like to watch and as a filmmaker and, you know, give them a good rating on Letterboxd. Like that's what I want. I want to make movies that I would like to watch and to enjoy as a cinephile and leave a legacy behind. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. But that's the dream. That's the dream.
Oren, I want to thank you for your time. Consider this a part one. Yeah. Like I know we didn't get through everything, and if you got, I know you have more to talk about.
I've got a ton
and
more
we
questions.
Talk, yeah, like we questions. Still have like a lot to still discuss. So whenever you're free, we feel free to come back.
Let's say it right now. This is part one. Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning, part one. or actually, we'll call this Dune. You know, like at the end of Dune, the first one where the movie was just called Dune, and then at the end, a title card comes up and it says Dune. Part one. And then you're like, oh, it's a part one. Interesting. Okay.
I'm going to make that graphic tonight.
Yes. And then we'll come back for part two for sure. I'd love to get through the other questions. Absolutely. We'll figure out a time.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you for your time, sir.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. You rock.
Yes.
Chat soon.
We're the Film Blurs. I'm Brandon Nord, and I'm the motherfucking protagonist.
I'm the protagonist.
I'm Jeff Stewart, a.k.a. He Who Remains.
Don't come at us. It's just fucking movies.
You've been listening to the Film Blurs podcast.
Man, I just love what you guys do, man.
I never miss an episode. It's the best. It's my favorite podcast.
Follow Jeff on IG on MindfireXL and Brandon on Twitter at BJNTweets.